twilight's last gleaming, whose stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, o'er the ramparts we watch, were so gallantly streaming.
Welcome, Sublation Media viewers, readers, all of you slimy communists out there. It's I, Douglas Lane, author of Bash Bash Revolution, head honcho at Sublation Media.
And I, Ashley Farrelly, sociologist at the University of Kent, and with much apologies to my subscribers over on, my subscribers over on my channel at Ashley A. Farrelly or at Based AF on all of the platforms, that I am very late with the podcast this week, but it's really, really good. I am trying to up my podcast game, and I'm putting weight. If it doesn't get a lot of views, I'm going to be really upset. So go over and watch it. I've made this little explanation of like how to mangle stats in 5 easy steps. So I also have a video coming out on Joseph Gusfield, my favorite sociologist who no one knows about, and you should all know about him. So if you want to learn about real proper sociology, how to think issues through and not get sucked into panics, come over to my channel.
All right, nice plug there, Ashley. And you should all be subscribed to Based AF. But listen, last week at this time, I was 6 hours in to a 15-hour live stream celebrating 15 years of podcasting. And I think it was a few hours after that, maybe 3 hours after that, that Ben Burgess came onto the live stream. Maybe it was 4 hours after. But in any case, I was, you know, fairly tired even at that point. Oh, I should point out, before I move on, what you just saw at the outset here was the Star Spangled Banner. It was sung by someone named Sandra, for public access television back in the 80s. And it is how the live stream ended. We ran that at the end. I was just chatting with John Bunch. Somehow after the live stream became public, you know, after we finished it, only about 11 hours actually are now available on YouTube. If you want to watch the whole live stream, it's on Twitter. I'm not sure exactly why that happened, but they clipped it by 3 hours. So about
corporate media censorship strikes again.
Yeah. So I'm going to be trying to cut up pieces of that stream. I feel like it was a success in so much as I completed it. I did not collapse in nervous exhaustion. I felt like it didn't quite present a coherent timeline of the podcast. You didn't get to see the way the left has altered. It all seemed very much of this moment. But that's okay. That's just how it goes.
I wanted more of the from chickens and spirituality to hardcore Marxism. I didn't get the feel of that, the timeline that I felt as a longtime listener.
Right. I mean, I didn't really start out as a, you know, true new ager or anything like that, but
admit it, Doug, you were all about chickens and doors to perception and all that stuff. I remember when I very first discovered Doug, everybody should go and have a look at the old podcast for Diet Soap. And they're not all there. They're not all there anymore. So I did look, and my very first appearance is not there, from 2012. Some of my favorites have been lost to the sands of time. But I remember when I very first discovered you, Doug, you were the only one. I remember I put out a request on Twitter. Is there anything else like diet soap out there? And somebody responded, I'm afraid not. It's the only one. So, Doug, you're a pioneer, and you've been hugely influential also on my own thinking as well. I've said many times, and I said, you know, on that stream, that you were kind of going through a political journey that I was also going through at the same time. You know, your podcast on Capitol and so on, it was when, you know, you started doing that during the crisis, the 2008 financial crisis or thereafter. And, you know, that's when I really started to get serious about trying to understand Marx and Marxism. So I will always be indebted to you, but I do remember scrolling back like, oh, I got to listen to all these podcasts. And like, as they went back further, they were a little less up my street, let's say.
Yeah, I had KMO on very early on the 15-hour stream. He was the podcaster behind the Sea Realm. He recently wrote a novel, which I'm going to bring him back on to talk about in depth. But he was not and is not a leftist of any kind. He's he was into the singularity concept, and then he was concerned about peak oil. He went and lived on the farm, which is his commune in Tennessee, for a while. So it was we were strange bedfellows, maybe, but it was great to see him again, talk to him again. And he is still podcasting. But let's get to the fight here. Let's get started on
what went down,
the Burgess portion. You know, Ben Burgess contacted me after I tweeted about the stream. He was unhappy that I kind of stepped back from the reconciliation that occurred during the stream and repeated something that he objects to and thinks is dishonest, which was that he claimed that the way in which the Biden administration contacted tech companies amounted to merely making recommendations. I said that was his position, when in fact all he claimed was that because it could be argued that the interference from the Department of Homeland Security amounted to recommendations, it was murkier than other instances in history. For instance, the one he gave was during the McCarthy era, the House of American Activities Committee. It was murkier than that the amount of state interference was not as clear cut, or, you know, was happening in the background. It was just not front and center and obvious. And I disagree with that now. I disagreed with that then.
You disagree that that's the point that he was making, or you disagree that it's murkier?
I disagree both with that it's murkier and also with what the political aim of claiming that it's murky is. Like the distinction between saying, oh, it could be argued and I would argue, is thinner than I think Burgess wants to admit even to himself. But that's the least compelling part of what I want to say. I mean, I that's me reading minds. I can't read his mind, but I can say that the effect of the argument was to diminish the significance of the war on disinformation as a political topic for the left. And I do think that is clear enough from watching the stream. But what I want to do before I get to a clip I have from the stream is run a different clip from the Bad Faith podcast. This is between Brianna Joy Gray and Zed Gilani. And here it is. I'm going to run it.
I think the audience that reads him on his Substack now is pretty right wing. Like, if you read their comments, if you read the kind of praise he gets, almost all of them basically seem to favor Republicans or favor conservatives in some way. And to me, that would be a reason for it to be even more important for him to be writing about, you know, the question was about sins from the right. It would be even more important for him to start engaging and writing and doing more critical reporting about the Republican Party and about conservatives and, you know, maybe their flaws and their issues, because his audience largely comes from those people, right? And they should know about their leaders and the flaws and sins of them, right? But, you know, I think that this is one of the drawbacks of having a media platform like Substack, where you build up your base of readers from folks who tend to come in and subscribe to you because they liked one article or two articles that went viral. You start thinking that maybe you need to satisfy, you know, their sort of interests, right? And your interests and their interests end up merging. It may not be a conscious thing. Like Matt may not have thought, look, I have very few Democratic Party aligned or progressive aligned readers, so I'm just not going to write about Republicans anymore because my base wants me to diss Democrats. I doubt he consciously said that, but nobody likes to write something and then like all your reader base is yelling at you, right? Or like you're losing subscriptions. You can see on Substack, like when I was working on Substack, you could see it every day with every post. You could see how many subscriptions you got, how many people turned off from you and like unsubscribed. I remember we wrote things that sometimes our audience wouldn't like when I was working with my friend on Substack, and we would get unsubscriptions and it felt bad, right? And you start to think to yourself, should I really be writing that? Then my audience all hates it. We did our best not let it get to us, but I think that over time it does get to you. I think this is the first time in his life that Tybee is a millionaire because of Substack. I think he's in the top 4 or 5 Substacks, at least in the news section for Substack. And look, I'm not trying to say that Tybee is like a complete sellout or anything, or that he just like doesn't have any integrity. I still think he's a very good writer. He does engage, I think, very artfully on a number of topics. But those topics do seem to be just completely aligned with his new reader base. And I'm disappointed to see someone who so artfully, I think, took down Goldman Sachs during the financial crisis. And he's not writing, let's give one example about Boeing, right? Boeing is going through one of its greatest crises in its history, largely due to, you know, greed and the financialization of the company and demoting of engineering and so on and so forth. I think this would be a perfect scandal for someone like a 2009 era Matt Tybee to be writing about, right? But instead he wrote like two different articles, I think it was two articles, about the new CEO of NPR.
All right. So I think that segment, that clip, has the same structure as Ben Burgess's appearance on the stream. There's one reason to run it. It's like, I'm going to say a lot of things and insinuate that Matt Taibbi is a right winger, but I'm going to also say he's okay and he's good and I like what he used to do and I'm not trying to condemn him as having no integrity. I'm certainly not saying he has no integrity. Let me say that again. I'm not claiming that he has no integrity. So there's that kind of rhetorical effect of the piece, but the thing I'd start with pointing out is that the CEO of NPR, who Matt Taibbi wrote about twice, was a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab. And the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab is one of the many organizations aimed at combating disinformation online. So
I missed the connection. So why is it important to point out NPR?
At the end, he said, he's not writing about Boeing, but he's writing he wrote two articles about the new CEO of NPR, as if that's just culture war nonsense to write about that. Have you heard about the NPR story that there was a whistleblower from NPR, which is National Public Radio, and who claimed that the standards of journalism had dropped off? And that they had been kind of captured, ideologically captured by an incoherent, I'm just going to say woke ideology. But it was more complicated than that. One of the examples that the whistleblower gave was their failure to adequately and accurately cover the Russiagate story. In other words, they were far too credulous of that story. What happened was that whistleblower was dismissed and a new CEO was appointed. And this new CEO at NPR is coming out of the Atlantic Council for Digital Forensic Research, the lab. So this is someone who's coming out of the new disinformation industry, the one of the warriors combating really combating the First Amendment and the idea of free speech online.
Right.
But so it makes sense, given Taibbi's larger project, that he would dedicate a few articles to discussing the ideology of this NPR executive. And it is actually a significant story, despite the fact that it has a culture war angle. It is part of the overall picture of the capture of media by the state, basically. So that's what I would want to start with. But the other things there that are important is it is not necessarily true that Taibbi's audience is conservative, or this is not self-evident that they are. I'm actually one of his subscribers on Patreon, on Substack.
Yes, but Doug, you don't say the chosen mantras. You don't heed the advice never to attack anyone who's vaguely left-wing or frames themselves in those ways. So that makes you very close to marching in jackboots.
Well, okay. I don't have any Well, I do have some boots, but the point is they're not jackboots, and they're hiking boots. And the other thing I'll say is that it would be listening to that clip from Bad Faith. The distinction between left and right is the distinction between the Democrats and Republicans. That's and Taibbi's reporting.
That's such a mad world to live in. I'm sorry that you live in this world and you have to litigate such a ridiculous. what? I feel like you guys are living what we lived, maybe like in the Corbyn era. And now everyone's just like, no one is stupid enough to think like, yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe there are a few people with like roses in their Twitter bios, but I'm not sure anyone is silly enough to think that Labour under Keir Starmer is anything other than a neoliberal handmaiden to state, you know, to the bureaucracy that runs this whole monstrous machine. I mean, you'd have to be really never venture outside of a nice warm cocoon to think such a thing. Is it really as widespread as that in the United States? Or are you in a Portland bubble, perhaps?
I live in the American left bubble. I'm looking at the comments now. Someone says, I am a conservative.
Yeah, the person wrote that before I said, if you don't say the right things, you're just marching in jackboots. But anyway, so I think that person probably realized as soon as the words came out of my mouth that they are being caricatures.
I don't know, but I'm 53 years old. I'm sure in many ways, there's some things about me that are conservative, or I cling to the past in a way that I would have thought when I was in my 20s I would never do. But nonetheless, I don't think I really am a conservative politically.
I think what's happened too is that the left has this idea that anything that doesn't wipe out the past entirely and build the world from year zero is somehow conservative. I mean, Marx was not that sort of person, you know. He wasn't sort of advocating that we build the world from nothing. It's a sort of basic understanding of civilization. So we build the world using what's available to us. But there's this notion, this very worrying and I think dangerous notion of trying to sort of wipe away everything, seeing everything that vaguely relates to conservatism as necessarily bad. And you know how I feel about the left stance on the family and on families, on, you know, people who are related to each other through usually some kind of genetic connection, but not always. This notion that like, oh no, anything that vaguely resembles that is necessarily conservative, forgetting about the fact that the vast majority of people live something like a family, and they care a lot about them, and they make sense of, they give meaning to their lives, make sense of their purpose in life on the basis of that kind of intergenerational continuity. And if you want to know more about this, I gave a paper on it at the University of Kent last week, which you can watch on the Parenting Culture Studies page, responded to by the leading guy in Europe, Claude Martin, on family. So if you want to have a look at that. But anyway, so, but there's this notion like, and in that paper, I talk about this weird crossroads between neoliberal suspicion of the family that seems to be getting laundered through a kind of communist discourse, a kind of rhetorical communization of an existing neoliberal destruction of the subject. And in that destruction of the subject is a suspicion of the family, because this is a kind of, what was it? I can't remember who it was, but that the I think it's a conservative thinker who said that the family is like the last bastion of anarchism in society. So this notion that people can have autonomy in that domain is viewed with a lot of suspicion, because you're going to screw things up, right? Anyways, I'm not going to go over that like we've done a million times, but that kind of year zero destructiveness accidentally crosses paths with neoliberalism. So you're not a conservative. You're not a conservative because you don't want to just wipe everything away and spit in people's faces because they value things and don't live in a polycule or whatever.
Well, I mean, the polycule thing is that's a separate thing. And the reason I'm not living in a polycule is because I don't live in a $2 million townhouse. But otherwise in Brooklyn or Park Slope, but you know, if I did, I'm sure I'd be much more open to all that kind of thing. All right. But back to the Ben Burgess appearance. Cause I want to get to that. We have a 25 minute clip to run from that. People who hadn't already seen it. So I want to start by just saying a few things to frame it. First of all, it's worth remembering that in 2003, a program called Total Information Awareness was started by the Bush administration. The idea behind the program, it was based on the concept of predictive policing. Total Information Awareness was meant to correlate detailed information about people in order to anticipate and prevent terrorist incidents before they happened. The program models specific information sets in the hunt for terrorists around the globe. Admiral John Poindexter called it a Manhattan Project for counterterrorism. And Senator Ron Wyden called it the biggest surveillance program in the history of the United States. Today, 21 years later, the Total Information Awareness Program has continued on, but it's morphed into a whole society effort to control information as well as to monitor it. So today's DHS, along with other federal agencies, have implemented this approach to control the flow of information. The DHS through CISA has committed it, the CISA, CISA, I guess, has committed itself to defeating foreign intelligence propaganda operations by targeting disinformation. Here are their three categories. There's misinformation, that's false information online or in the media that's created and shared but doesn't intend to cause harm. There's disinformation, which is deliberately created to mislead, harm, or manipulate a person, social group, organization, or country. And then there's malinformation, which is based on fact but used out of context to mislead, harm, or manipulate. An example of malinformation is editing a video to remove important context to harm or mislead. But another example of malinformation would be posting during the COVID pandemic reports of harms that people suffered from the vaccine, the unintended side effects of the vaccines. There were many incidences of it. Of course there were, because there always are with vaccines. But to report on them was a form of malinformation, would get you censored from Twitter and Facebook and places like that. So that's the context here. The other thing I want to point out is that the House of Un-American Activities Committee back in 1938 and running through the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s, I think, was created in order to investigate disloyalty and subversive activities on the part of private citizens, public employees, and organizations that were suspected of having communist or fascist ties. Its primary objectives were to investigate communist and fascist organizations, examine the activities of other groups on the political left, ferret out suspected communists by issuing subpoenas and grilling individuals about their political beliefs, to question individuals about their affiliations and ask them to provide the names of others involved in allegedly subversive activities, and uncover vital information that bolstered national security. Although critics at the time charged that it was a partisan tool bent on discrediting the New Deal programs of FDR. This is not dissimilar at all from what the war on disinformation people are doing. They too would say they are investigating, researching, examining, and they are surveilling only and then analyzing. That's what the EIP said about what it was doing during the 2020 election. They also make recommendations to tech companies on who is spreading disinformation according to their narratives, and which are always changing. But it's worth pointing out that at the time, the blacklist was created by private companies in reaction to the House of Un-American Activities Committee. And that the suggestion, the argument that, oh, well, we're only making recommendations, I think would have applied equally to McCarthy and his friends, as it does to the EIP and the Department of Homeland Security today. And so the my point here is just to say that, you know, Burgess raises this as a counterexample, one that's much clearer, but I think it's only more clear because as someone on the left, you know ahead of time that the McCarthy era, you know, in the House of Un-American Activities Committee is bad. And they're not targeting the people, they're targeting people you like. So therefore, it's clearer that it's state censorship. But in fact, pretty much the approaches are identical.
I mean, it really should just be the most obvious thing. I mean, surely most people do this when you're sort of forming an opinion. Do you flip it around the other way and be like, okay, am I being intellectually honest here? Would I say the same thing if it was people that I don't like or opinions that I don't like? I do that constantly. Like, I'm always flipping in my head. Like, it often surprises me when people get very angry about things. Like, the obvious one being, like, Elon Musk saying we can't say cisgender anymore on Twitter, which lasted all of like 5 minutes, I imagine. But people were like, oh, see, censorship. And I was like, well, you were saying it wasn't censorship before, but now it is. Surely you recognize that there's an inconsistency there. So, you know, if it's questionable and scary when it happens to you, it's questionable and scary when it happens to your opponents too, because of course it's going to be used against you eventually. Well, you can't trust that you're always going to have the upper hand, particularly when people were sort of, all of a sudden the capitalists were all on their side with censorship around DEI and all of these, you know, corporate awareness and mental health and so on. It's like, wow, we're in this unique moment of awareness. It's great. I mean, of course we're not, you know. As soon as people like that start saying this sort of thing, you have to start asking yourself, why am I being offered a scholarship to say this? Why am I being taught this by my employer in my workplace? Why is this thing that I thought was so great now being used against me? I mean, surely that should be any kind of test for your critical thinking.
Yeah, I agree. The next thing I want to point out is that that there's a bit where he said that Burgess argues that there was no direct threat from the government aimed at the tech companies. And I always like to point out, it's not just tech companies. They also infiltrated and directed the way things were reported within the mainstream media as well. And the EIP long fuse document makes it clear that setting the frameworks for reporting in news agencies and newspapers was a part of the agenda. But there was direct threats and indirect threats. But Adam Schiff told reporters, if the social media companies can't exercise a proper standard of care when it comes to a whole variety of fraudulent or illicit content, then we have to think about whether that immunity still makes sense. These are not nascent industries or companies that are struggling for viability. They're now behemoths, and we need them to act responsibly. Burgess wondered if threatening to take away Section 230 really is a threat to put them out of business. You know, I guess it's debatable, but I think he has a very weak argument. The Electronics Frontier Foundation, a nonprofit founded to protect civil liberties online, states the free and open internet as we know it couldn't exist without Section 230. Important court rulings on Section 230 have held that users and services cannot be sued for forwarding email, hosting online reviews, or sharing photos or videos that others find objectionable. It also helps to quickly resolve lawsuit cases that have no legal basis. You have to remember that we're talking about social media companies that have billions of users. If they were to have to edit them, put them through some sort of review process to measure or evaluate their likelihood for being libelous or in some way opening up the company to lawsuits, it simply just will be impossible to allow the public to post, basically. So on any kind of scale, like as we've become accustomed to. So threatening to take away Section 230 is a threat to take away the very kind of foundation of the legal foundation, which has a material effect that these companies rely on. So I'm stating the arguments that I tried to make during the stream. I felt that I was surprised that Burgess took the positions he did, and I thought he kind of filibustered. So I want to make them out up front now. Shall we run that?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly say, like, I think people might be more sympathetic if you kind of like framed it, not you, if one frames it through a nice, cozy, safe leftist, Noam Chomsky, and the propaganda model, which I'm sure any punk rock kid will have become aware of in the last few decades, where censorship doesn't have to be, and most often is not, in our liberal democratic societies, exercised directly. It's through subtle enforcements. I mean, just because so it would be like responding to Chomsky, looking at the five filters that are in action when the news is being produced and saying, oh, well, who cares? Because it's not direct censorship. So whatever.
I mean, but in this case, if we think the House of Un-American Activities Committee's blacklist of actors was a form of direct censorship, then this is too. And it is, after all, the state directly setting up terms for what is allowed and what is not. If you're working if you're working for the military and you're a reporter, you hand your reports over. I remember watching the movie Good Morning Vietnam. All my references are to old movies, but you know, he was a journalist. He had to put the news through the censors, and they would go take it and they'd mark it up with red and say what could be said and what couldn't. That was direct censorship from the military of what could be put on the air on a military radio station, you know, an army radio. That's what we're dealing with now when it comes to social media. It is that level of control, although it's, you know, erratic because it's done by AI, which might not always be accurate in what it catches. So those people with the red pencils aren't people at all anymore. But essentially, this is not the same as the old structural model that Noam Chomsky wrote about. You know, in Manufacturing Consent, this is another thing I put down. They talk about structural factors that dominate media operations and are not all controlling and do not always produce simple and homogeneous results. It's well recognized and may even be said to constitute a part of an institutional critique, such as we present in this volume, quoting them, that the various parts of media organizations have some limited autonomy, that individual and professional values influence media work, that policy is imperfectly enforced, and that media policy itself may allow some measure of dissent and reporting that calls into questions the accepted viewpoint. That is the old structural critique from Chomsky, you know, it's saying, look, even in the so-called free market, when you have so much concentration of capital into a few corporate hands and the media and a kind of sympathetic relationship between the state and these big tech companies for structural reasons, you're going to have a very limited range of acceptable opinion reach the public. That is the old Manufacturing Consent propaganda model. What we're dealing with now is the state directly telling media companies and social media companies what is not to be reported on in advance and on a mass scale.
Right.
So So this is the kind of censorship that doesn't require a complicated sociological analysis because it's so direct. And I just think that's
said, like, even in the propaganda model. Okay, I know you want to run the clip. Let's just do it.
Oh, okay. No, go ahead. Go ahead. Say what you're going to say.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, like, I think it also accounts for the fact that it can sometimes be direct, you know, that it's accounted for in FLAC, I think.
Yeah, no.
But this is more than FLAC. This is more than FLAC. But, like, for instance, you know, I remember on Sky News, somebody went on, a friend of mine, actually, and she started calling, like, the Pope a pedophile. And, like, literally, there was a directive that came down that said, never flippin' have this woman on ever again. Never again. Mm. So, you know, that's, like, flack that came down from on high. That is a not-so-subtle disciplinary measure, right? So if you, right. You may be, like... It may not be an injunction that says never have anyone on that calls the Pope a pedophile. You know, it may not be a written law anywhere, but you do get a strong sort of more like you can get like an injunction that says, you know, never have this person on again if they do that. You know, so if you break the rules, like sure, you're invited not to, but mm-hmm. you're invited to believe that you have the option. But what will happen if you break the rules? It's the same. I'm not sure that it is so different, maybe. I don't know.
No, I'm not saying that. Look, there's a reason why the distinction is worth making. And mm-hmm. that the reason why it's worth making is because when you have even multiple corporations owning the media and making their own decisions, there is even according to the propaganda model, some room for autonomy, even if limited. Autonomy within these media organizations. And the aim of the Department of Homeland Security and the war on disinformation in total is to stamp out all dissent and criticism. Or anything they would label as disinformation. And what they would label as disinformation is anything that goes against the official narrative. So if you say something like, you know, the United States pushed Russia into invade by encroaching upon, you know, its borders and breaking agreements that Clinton had set up after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The United States knew that this was a provocation to arm Ukraine. That's disinformation, right? And there are algorithms in place to limit that and things open up and close up based on the needs of the state at the time. But the point is the aim is to create conditions where not only aren't those things posted, but you don't think to post them right as well. So that's in some ways, maybe that's like the manufacturing consent. But the other reason it's important to point out is that we are not protected from, in the United States, from private censorship, because private censorship is built into private free expression. I have the right to start a press and curate it. That means censoring people and not allowing anyone to come on and say what they want. I have the right to create a press. So free speech is complicated. And includes censorship and expression. But the state has no right to intervene in civil society to determine what should be said. The First Amendment protects the civil society, everyday people, from state intervention. And this is the limiting the power of the state and maintaining even the somewhat broken forms of free expression that we have is an important thing to do. Understanding that distinction helps us to understand what the goal of really modernity, not just socialism, but modernity or liberal democracy is. The goal is not to create the perfect state that makes everything harmonious. through the use of violence and force, but rather to free everyday people and what's called civil society, the collective of everyday people, so that they can self-govern, so that they the state works for them and not the other way around. So.
So how do you want to run this? You want to pause it every now and then and every now and then and rant? Or do you want to
watch? No, I think I've done all my ranting up front. Let's just run it and then we can talk for a minute. It's about 25 minutes long, so we'll only have about 5 minutes after before we have
and
to
then
go to
the Patreon.
Yeah. So
you'll hear what Doug really thinks in the Patreon.
Oh wow. Yeah, I was really holding back up to now. All right, let's see here. No, that's not the right file. Always going to the start. I could run the Star Spangled Banner again. Here we go.
Very I'm professional
at
segue.
The point now where I think that this is very maybe libertarian or bourgeois, but I think that if we were living under conditions where a few big tech companies could decide who could talk and who couldn't based on their individual whims, that we would be better off than we actually are right now. What's happening now is that because of a multitude of organizations' interference, but primarily I point to the Department of Homeland Security, we have moderation, we have policies that are being put in place by some sort of basically the NATO line is being implemented across as far across the board as is possible. So like the fact that there are still a few private capitalists out there bucking the trend, like Rumble or X, or at one point Parler even, is a good thing. Even if it is all for private profit and you know, even if it isn't the communist utopia that you might want to produce, so you could have true and full free speech rights. It's better. We're better off when there's a diversity, the kind of diversity that emerges from competition between capitalists, rather than where the tech companies have to bow down to the state in order to maintain their business license or have the executive take it away.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you're going to have, it's like if we lived in a libertarian dystopia where all the streets were owned by individual rich people, then I would much rather have the main street in town be owned by like a free speech billionaire who would let people have protest marches down the street than have it be owned by a non-free speech billionaire, you know, who wasn't willing to allow that. And certainly if you had the DHS in here applying any sort of pressure that would, you know, for on people to be more like the second kind, that would be bad, right? But I also don't think you should have to just sort of hope that, you know, that you're that it's that you have sort of that the that you have like relatively benevolent capitalists, not relatively less benevolent capitalists, making these decisions about what we can say and what we can't say, and all of that, right? I think that it's I think that is a problem, right? You know, and by very rough analogy, right? You know, you think about like the, you know, McCarthyism in the 1950s, you know, that this is that there's certainly actually a much clearer way there, right? You know, than there is right now. Because a lot of what we're talking about, you know, I think with the DHS stuff is sort of behind the scenes, and it's you know, maybe a little unclear how much it's just sort of like what exactly the levers of pressure are, and it's not good, you know, regardless. But I think that, you know, like in the 1950s case, it's much clearer. You know, you have that you have like very loudly right? You know, you have people in government, you know, demanding that, you know, companies, Hollywood studios, for example, purge commies, and them actually doing it, right?
I'm going to push back on this, but
just to finish the thought, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not if we sort of had an immaculate Red Scare, right? That the sort of Red Scare that Robert Nozick couldn't have an objection to, where you had it was purely the patriotic zeal of studio bosses that led them to institute a blacklist. And it had absolutely nothing to do with government pressure. I mean, I guess that'd be slightly better, but like, I actually don't think it would be much better.
It would be way better. And two things. One, now the state didn't hide that they were directly calling upon the tech companies to censor speech. That was said over and over again. People like Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, and others. It's been and the threats came directly as well. The threat was to basically take away their business license by making them no longer protected from lawsuits. You know, that's
an odd basically sentence, right? Those are two very different things.
No, they would tie the two things together. Either you do something about disinformation, or we will take away your protection from litigation.
No. I get that, right? Like, I have that's still a very different thing from taking away a business license, you know, is saying that, you know, well, that you don't have this special protection isn't given to other kinds of businesses, etc., right? You know, that, like, because, you know, it's, and you know, it's very, and don't get me wrong, I think it would be bad to
it'd be like saying you don't have the, we're no longer going to rent the telephone poles to you if you're the telephone company.
I think it would be like saying that. I think that they have it would maybe be like saying that, I don't know what the analogy would be in this case, but I mean, like, you know, but you're talking about immunity from people suing you, right? Like not giving it immunity from private citizens suing you does seem to be very unlike saying you can't have a business license or you can't use the telephone poles, right? Like I think pragmatically it would be bad to take it away, because
it's the same in so much as the companies couldn't function without that legal protection.
I don't know,
just like the telecommunication companies couldn't function without being able to rent the telephone poles, in my example. The threat would have been cataclysmic if acted upon. It would have at the very least broken them up, but probably meant the end of social media as we understand it. Because you would have to have editors in between the users on social media and
I think they would get much more censorious if that happened, which would be very bad. I don't know that it would mean, like, it would probably just be that, you know, there'd be a much lower threshold for being censored because people, you know, because they'd be worried about being sued, which again would be bad, but I think it would be bad it'd be bad for.
But the second point. So if you don't think that it would have been. That's the threat to put them out of business. Okay, I disagree. But then the second point is, in the case of today's censorship, as opposed to during the McCarthy era, we actually have, and maybe there is, this exists in McCarthy era, and I don't know about it, but we actually have the paper trail. And we know of the institutions that were created in order to direct the censorship.
Well, this is what I'm saying. In the McCarthy era, it wouldn't be like, oh my God, we discovered a paper trail. You just open the newspaper, right? Like, this isn't,
you could open the newspapers now as well. Many newspapers were calling for the censorship of tech. Many newspapers were calling for censorship.
Not saying you open
Hold on, wait, no. I'm saying that unlike during the McCarthy era, the direct pressure put from the state onto the tech companies is documented. It's not just a matter of some public statements. It's also the systematic and institutionalized, technologically implemented system of monitoring and controlling what was said.
So what were the I mean, this is something you know much more about than I do, you know, partially because I for reasons I've been sort of going through, I find it largely irrelevant. I don't think it like quite, you know, I think that whatever's true about this, I think it's a bit of a sideshow, right? It's not the main problem, but since you do know much more about this, I mean, what was the, you know, like in this paper trail, you know, what was the sort of, you know, what were the pressure points? I mean, what was the, you know, they would say here's the stuff that we want you to censor, and if you don't do it,
well, the first of all, they created a hub for the state officials and for NGOs and for the intelligence community to communicate with the tech companies. So that's, I'm not talking about the pressure point anymore. I'm talking about level of control.
But I think that this is the, you know, it's only the level of control.
If you had letters and phone calls documented and recorded where J. Edgar Hoover called up the editor of the New York Times and said, do not publish that guy, never hire him. And that was recorded. That's the level that we've got when it comes to censorship online. Only it's not one guy, it's tens of thousands.
You know, New York Times has, of course, gotten many documented requests to, you know, to not publish things from the national security state over the decades they've usually ceded to them. But I think that what I'm saying is in terms of, you know, like the distinction, because I think the difference between us here is not that if the state is encouraging corporate censorship, that's bad. We agree on that. But how bad is corporate censorship if it's
I'll put it to you this way. Manufacturing Consent was written to demonstrate that corporate censorship could, in some ways, nearly but not quite, reach the level of state censorship. If you read Manufacturing Consent, people thought it was a little hyperbolic, but it was saying, look, sure, we're not the Soviet Union, but we have our own form of censorship.
I guess it's been a long time, but my memory of Manufacturing Consent was that it wasn't really about censorship per se, right? Like it was...
It was, but it was about the more covert. It was not direct.
Because it was about propaganda, right? I mean, right. In other words, it's less about censorship than it is about like how narratives are shaped, right? And it's also, there's also a really important distinction here because I think that a lot of, in fact, look, something that a lot of conservatives will point out that I actually agree with them about is that there's a fundamental distinction, right? Even without any sort of element of government encouragement or coercion, or, you know, again, I think what pressure points there are, I think, is a really important question for filling out that story. But even something a lot of conservatives will point out is it's like, look, there's a fundamental difference between a organization like the New York Times and an organization like Twitter or YouTube, right? That a media, like a publisher, is like, it's completely fine for a publisher to have an editorial line to sort of determine, you know, like what's worth publishing and what isn't, right? That's all legitimate, right? That the, you know, there are sort of free speech adjacent questions we could ask about that, right, that I wouldn't want to dismiss. But, I mean, there is a sort of core legitimacy to all of that. Whereas if you're talking about Twitter or YouTube, you know, then you're not talking about publisher, right? You're talking about things that are supposed to be a neutral platform, that are supposed to, they're supposed to fill this role as a neutral platform. And that makes corporate censorship, even if it's initiated at the corporate level with zero government encouragement, much more disturbing. It would be like if we privatized the post office and, you know, one of the companies that ended up like sort of taking up a big share of what had been the business of USPS, you know, decided that we're not going to carry certain magazines through the mail because we disapprove of their political content because like they're against the war in Ukraine or something, right? That would be more the equivalent than like the New York Times making an editorial decision.
Okay, well, I want to think about this for a second because I'm tempted to agree with you, but I want to clarify something here. But sure. The First Amendment, the people whose rights were trod upon weren't fundamentally the tech companies, right? Every user of social media has First Amendment rights. They can be intruded upon by private companies. Okay. So like if I don't have the responsibility to publish any book.
Yeah.
Okay. And Twitter or Facebook, they don't actually have to post anyone's posts. They can decide arbitrarily who they allow to publish and to post or not. They're not the same thing as they're not treated the same way as the post office or the telephone companies. They are somewhere in between, but they have the right to create their own moderation policies. The trouble here, reason this is so extreme,
legally they have the right. That's the problem.
Right. Well, but listen, that's an earlier argument. Okay, that's before what we know now. What the reason this is so extreme is the state constitutionally it is not allowed to intervene to censor anyone's speech. So not only did the state intervene and censor the speech of the tech companies, but they're also intervening to censor the speech of the first one that comes to mind is RFK Jr. And he was a prominent example of someone who was censored on Twitter. But it was really millions of people whose speech was suppressed systematically, both, you know, on the one hand, you had threats of deregulation that would put these companies out of business. On the other side, you had FBI agents and others communicating daily with the companies. And further, you had hubs of communication. It's like well beyond just opening up a Slack chat, but it's like a Slack chat between the Department of Homeland Security, the CDC, three or four nonprofit organizations funded by the federal government, founded by the Department of Homeland Security, all communicating with the tech and media, not just social media, but all of them. And their long fuse report, they say, our goal should be to continue to help set the moderation policies for these companies. To influence reporting on every level within mainstream media. Yeah. By embedding into these organizations. And pre-bunking stories before they arose would be part of it. I mean, what was being exerted here was an attempt to exert basically of control over all of the communications infrastructure in the country.
Yeah. So if you're talking about a legal constitutional question, right, then they're certainly not allowed to legally force companies to print something or not to print something. But you know, maybe you know more about the First Amendment jurisprudence here that's relevant, that's already happened, than I do. But my understanding would be that it's at least much less clear that it's illegal, right? It's unconstitutional, you know, to make requests, right? So like when the New York Times, for example, you know, infamously delayed its reporting about like the CIA black sites in Europe for like a year until after the 2004 election at the, you know, at the request of, you know, whoever in the Bush administration, CIA, whatever, who, you know, muttered some, you know, half-baked nonsense about national security in their ear, you know, say that they shouldn't report it. They said, okay. Like, I don't know that there's any court ruling that would say that that was illegal, right?
There are court rulings on this. Yes.
Because I know, because if they'd said, if they'd tried to do what they did, like with the Pentagon Papers, and say like, oh, we're going to like actually try to stop you from legally stop you from printing this, right? That's definitely illegal. But just to make the request, it's unclear to me that it is. And
there was a case with a bookstore where the bookstore received several requests to no longer carry, like I think a sex manual or some sort of sexual education material. And it was at a state level.
Okay.
And the court found that that amounted to basically a violation of the First Amendment due to the matter of pressure.
Supreme Court case, or is this like?
Yeah, I think it was a Supreme Court case.
Okay. Because you know, say like that sort of thing happens quite frequently. And if they were able to, you know, if it went through court and they were able to win the case, presumably a big part of how the government would be able to win the case there would be to say, look, you know, there's no legal force here. You know, there's just a request that a private company voluntarily complied with.
But in fact, there is a legal case that would surely
be their argument. And what that argument would rely on is precisely the petty despotism of the private company that can do whatever they want. Because it's their property, right? You know, right, you could have a government that was constrained by a First Amendment requesting that a street owner not allow protesters to go down the street, and they would have at least a much better case that they weren't violating the First Amendment, that if it were a public street, they just hadn't allowed it.
Okay. That has been adjudicated on. There has been a case. There's precedent for simply requesting that something be censored amounting to a First Amendment violation.
Okay.
However, that's not what we're talking about in this case. We're talking about creating institutions whose purpose is to censor.
Yeah, but that's
within the government. Within the government.
But that's fundamentally, if you're just talking about an institution to streamline requests that the private owner can then still make the call about whether to honor the requests or not, then you are still very much in the territory of, is the request itself unconstitutional? Now, maybe you're right, and there's like some, you know, there's some body of clear enough Supreme Court precedents that this is settled law. Like I said, I wouldn't claim to know as much about this as you do, right? But I would imagine that, you know, that to the extent that there's any kind of legal ambiguity about that, then it would be precisely because that it's still ultimately the call of the media oligarchs whether to honor the request or not, which does sort of get back to my sort of core argument that it's like, look, I don't think we should have this sort of impoverished libertarian conception of free speech. I think that.
Yeah, but I think you're being completely disingenuous here, Ben. I mean, I'm frankly a little appalled because you're using the stronger, an apparently stronger argument
Okay.
For free speech to justify
No, I'm not. I'm going to stop you right there, Doug. That's not true. I'm
violation. Hold on.
You know I'm not justifying it.
Oh, hold on.
No, Doug, sorry.
To argue for the Democratic Party's case that's coming up to the Supreme Court and push and push and push as if it's reasonable, it is not reasonable. Okay? There has been precedents before just showing that if you just chat them up.
Doug, I'm not saying it's reasonable. I've said the opposite.
If you just chat them up, you are violating the First Amendment. That's been shown in the past. You also are, the government can pass no law to infringe upon.
Doug,
they certainly can't build an institution.
If you're going to rant and mute me, I'm going to have to say goodbye.
Okay.
But they have a...
I mean, you were talking, I was trying to intervene before, and I'd like to be able to finish my thought as well. And I don't want to be interrupted. I want to get to the end of the point. Okay. And I'm not ranting. I'm telling you the facts as I understand them.
Yeah, but you were lying about my position. You said I was justifying it. I was absolutely not.
Whatever your self-conception is,
I'm just not. That's a lie. That's not true.
How is that a lie?
I'm not justifying it. I'm against it. I've told you over and over again that I'm against it. I'm in print talking about how I'm
against it. Why do you think I think you're against it? I mean, why do I think you're justifying it? Why do you think I'm saying you're justifying it?
Because I think that on this particular subject, you tend to get worked up and you tend to assume that anything that's not sufficiently enthusiastic agreement on every single aspect of what you're saying must be people secretly taking the position that you see yourself as being against.
All right. So, So that was a heated exchange. And watching it again now, I think there are some things that are more clear to me now than have been even up to this point. That when he says that I have an impoverished view of free speech based on kind of a libertarian understanding where the distinction between private and public is paramount, I believe that's what he's saying. That is the key to understanding where our disagreement is, because I don't believe that that the free market is adequate to develop a fully operative world where true free expression can take hold. I agree with the old Chomsky model for its time, but I do believe that when we no longer have even the formal protection of the constitutional rights that are enshrined in the Bill of Rights, when that is overturned, we are risking a level of basically thought control that goes well beyond what we've experienced up till now. Window or the frame of acceptable opinion is narrowing. And it's narrowing in a way which takes away, which is taking away the rights of people within civil society. Individuals are losing their rights in this moment. So that's what I'm so concerned about. And that does have to do with wanting to protect the individual people against the state, which is something that libertarians of the right-wing variety are concerned with it, but that doesn't mean I only have this impoverished libertarian perspective on the matter. But that's
what you're saying is he thinks you're being too soft on state, on oligarchy, on media oligarchies, by focusing so much on the state.
Right. Yes. Okay. So I have a couple of reasons why I react so negatively to that charge. What he's done is he's taking an issue which has to do with people in civil society standing up for their individual rights and collective rights outside of the state and turned it into something that you could maybe run a Democratic Party candidate on, which is regulating big tech. So now instead of it being standing up for our individual rights within civil society, it's turned into an issue that can kick back and forth like Medicare for All. Doomed to failure, but the right position. And I'm not sure it's even the right position, but that's one thing that infuriates me about it. So one of the consequences of this story for me was that along with the threat of nuclear war, those two things combined was for me to realize, oh yeah, the Democrats truly are no better than the Republicans, that it's the state formation itself as it is that I have to oppose. I mean, I'm kind of returning to my old anarchist days in a sense, but not without abandoning the Marxist aim of seizing the state and seizing the means of production, but eventually down the road. But right now, we just need to recognize that civil society should be in charge and not just constantly turn around to, look for the most progressive part of the Democrats to come up with the right policy proposal. Now, I mean, look, he didn't say these things. I'm extrapolating out from his position, and I'd be glad to be corrected about what I'm saying now, or not really glad, but if I'm wrong, I will accept that. But that's what's behind my feelings of fury around this. But that and a variety of other things. It really comes down to this feeling that, okay, you know, that certain leftists are just insisting on not taking up the depth of betrayal that has occurred. Yeah, and Secret Agent Dan says, my feelings of fury. Yes, I have feelings of fury.
Okay, so I had to take notes during this discussion because, not being steeped in American politics, I find every time that you mention acronyms and funnel this through a dispute and a feud between about Democrats, I get completely lost. The one good thing about this is you're getting a fully etic perspective, as the anthropologists say, the outsider perspective for me. But I was just trying to filter it through sort of the context that I understand. And for me, it's just obvious. It appears obvious, perhaps because I live in a bubble of, you know, a certain kind of dissent, but that corporate, like, reining in corporate freedom and harm online is a thin veneer for state authorities to control speech online. And I cannot imagine that could seriously become an issue. Well, I suppose I could, that people could get on board with, you know, that this could become like a Democrats versus Republican issue where it's like, yeah, of course we want censorship online because that's good for the left somehow.
Well, I mean, in the hearings on the weaponization of government, where Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger testified, the Democrats again and again made an argument for censorship. We have to control what's said online because, you know, people will use the N-word. We can't.
Yeah,
allow
and
that.
In the UK and in the EU and the UK and in Europe, they talk about child pornography. That's the front for it. And obviously, like, that makes you like an evil, bad person the moment you're like, well, hold on a second, because is this not a Trojan horse for all the other kinds of censorship you want in? But then you're like the person who's like supposedly defending child pornography. It's a wonderful little trick that they do. It's a wonderful little trick.
Child pornography is illegal already. You don't have to implement these new institutions to control and fight disinformation in order to stop the spread of child pornography or fraudulent claims. Even you can go after snake oil salesmen who are defrauding people. You can, there's all sorts of speech which is already within the realm of illegality. The thing about this, the war on disinformation, is that quite a lot of speech, most speech in the United States anyway, is legally protected. I think this is one of the things that doesn't communicate well to people in Europe or even in Canada, which is that we have very strong free speech protection in the United States. Really, it's unique. If there's one thing that I truly like about being an American, it's that. I mean, there's quite a lot I don't like about being an American, but it's this sort of insistence on total freedom in the realm of speech when you can't directly demonstrate harm, like through like fraud or child pornography or something like that, that I want to protect. And I want to protect it on the level of individuals, for individuals first, and then on the level of the free press, the right for people to form organizations and corporations even that will, that like media companies, like Sublation Media, you know? I want to be able to, for people of all types to make a shot, take a shot at producing books, movies, TV shows, whatever. The way it's looking right now, when you take up all the combination of things that are happening on the state level and the federal level and internationally, that's just going to be shut down. The effort to ban TikTok has given the executive the power to simply shut down media companies that are deemed to be a national security threat because they're repeating foreign propaganda. Right there, I mean, that's sort of the end of the story with that, the passage of that bill. All the stuff before about the NGOs and the secret networks of censorship, that's just a also ran kind of story. But nonetheless, it's there. And even without the TikTok ban, we are facing a new form of society, not just like a new level of censorship, but truly an attempt to create a new form of society where there's just far less freedom in the United States. And with the loss of that freedom in the United States, there will be the loss of the idea of it as well, I think. So that's why I ran the Star Spangled Banner at the start, by the way.
I thought that was a very good way to end it, that I am proud to be an American. All right, so let's carry on. In the Patreon, and all I want to talk about. I had a thought in my mind about hate speech and how that has become like a banner for the left, and this is a problem.
All right, I'm going to run that Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, say